Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we're going to, you know, it was funny, Bob, when we talked about doing a Pinstamen show, I reflected back to the Latin word of the week, how we always laugh about almost every example. There's a Pinstamen or a Carex.
Well, I'm laughing with you, not at you. I want you to know that.
So we're going to find out more about Pinstamen today, finally, in their own right. We're going to speak with Dale Lindgren, who's with the University of Nebraska.
Good man. He spent a lot of his lifetime hunting down the native Pinstamen. And it's a plant with a PR problem because its other name is beard tongue. The poor thing. Because it faintly resembles a tongue coming out of a beard, if you will.
Okay, there you go.
But a great history to it. The Dakota Indian used it to treat chest pains. I'm sorry. The Kiowa to treat stomach aches. The Pawnee made a tea out of it. It grows native from Maine to Texas to North Dakota. Hundreds of different plants out there.
That's why there's always a Latin word of the week.
Exactly.
That has a Pinstamen
because there's several gazillion examples of it.
And what's interesting, too, I think, and Dale will be able to speak to this as well, University of Nebraska Horticulture Department and the research that he has done has focused on this whole native plant thing, but not in that true sense of the, just native plants, but selecting really fancy, great, robust cultivars, named cultivars from this native plant sort of categories. One of the most famous ones I think that came out of there is the Husker Red.
The 1996 perennial plant
the
year.
Yep,
you
I got
go
it.
Husker Red.
And baby, you know I got it in my garden.
You betcha. If it's easy, you got it, right?
Yeah. So we'll find out more about that coming up here pretty soon, so stick with us. And also, we're going to learn a little bit more about the beginnings of Earth Day. Earth Day, I think it's, you know, at least for my generation, something we kind of take for granted. There are so many different Earth Day celebrations. It's been around long enough for 20 years that it's recognizable, if you will.
Yeah.
But it started out in a really basic sort of way back in Wisconsin. A senator there,
Gaylord Nelson.
Gaylord Nelson started it, and we're going to take a look at the beginnings of Earth Day and kind of how far it's come and how did. You know, isn't it cool how somebody's sort of dream or notion of teaching and encouraging people to be environmental stewards can blossom into something that is embraced nationwide and worldwide? And how does that happen?
And someday an Earth Week, an Earth Month, and an Earth Year.
Yeah.
They had like 1,000 people at the Clarksville, the Wells, Ohio, for
and
celebrations.
And at the zoo and at the, I mean, just everywhere.
Right.
And just how it grows so easily, and I guess the key is that it was a grassroots sort of movement.
And it's the right thing.
And it is the right thing. Yeah. You said
that eventually outs after a while.
Yeah.
In spite of mankind.
The right thing is the right thing to do. Absolutely.
The right thing, Miss Wishy, what's going on in your garden?
Well, just everything is so incredibly crisp and clean and beautiful this time of the year because it's spring and it's all fresh. And what I was noticing the other day, you remember when we first moved out to the farm a couple years ago? And how I really worked on the back area behind the house, you know, close to the house,
the new
shade garden area.
Yeah, somebody got married out there.
Yeah, yeah. But this
one
spring,
of us two got married out there.
This spring, it's really, you know, it's had a chance to be in there, and it's coming back fresh, and it just really looks beautiful. And this combination, and this was just luck, I guess, because I'm not like this great garden designer or anything, but there's a combination of this epimedium called Orange Queen.
Wow.
So these sweet little orange flowers.
I don't have that one,
and then the pretty kind of clean green, you know, foliage from the epimedium. The woodland poppy.
Yep.
The yellow bloom, right?
Yeah. Indefatigable.
Uh-huh.
It's everywhere.
Yes. The Jacob's ladder, that really pretty kind of periwinkle blue.
Yep.
And then this hosta that is like a chartreuse color and just a clear green. And the combination of those plants is just lovely. Just lovely that I've like kind of like, well, I'm just so proud of myself, what I've done here.
Yeah.
But
that's why I think
it's just a fluke because I don't always, can't always envision that.
Next year you won't get the same symphony.
Right, it'll be,
The fiddles or the trumpets or something will be out of a tune.
Right. Or even prettier or just different somehow. But just really taking a look at the freshness of all this stuff. And back there too, and you reminded me when you said the fiddle, as the ferns start to emerge, they're almost prettier, still sort of coiled in their fuzzy ferndom, you know, before they open up.
Yeah.
Almost prettier that way than, you know, the rest of the season.
What I noticed in my place is the how fleeting the color was on the trees this year. We had that real hot day. Remember, we got in the 80s on a Friday.
And it blew things pretty
quick,
didn't it?
Yeah, the buds went from vibrant on Tuesday to gone on Sunday.
You're right.
But still, it was a great it was a great Tuesday, like
well,
you say.
That's, that one day was, the colors are just so vibrant. So what's going on in your garden, Bob?
Well, I've been waiting for a couple of years for two particular plants to bloom pretty well. One did. One's called a yellowhorn. You ever seen that?
Well, at your place.
Yeah, I love it. It's a little. It's a white flower with a gold, kind of gold center. It's just busting, hundreds of them all over the place.
And this is the first time you've had it bloom.
Yeah, that I noticed. Uh-huh. Another one called Pearl Bush, which is just this incredibly bright white. I think it's X-Cordia, something like that. Incredible bright white flowers, sort of look a little bit like a mock orange, but more, even more bright than that. And you don't see them in the landscape much, and they're not. Maybe for a reason, but I wait for years for these little babies to come along.
Because they'll be dead in a month.
I was kidnapping people and taking them on tours of these things. You got to come see these plants because they're blooming. The other one is a magnolia called Daybreak.
What color?
Pink. And it's the size of, it's about 8 or 10 inches across. Very fragrant. It's the prettiest magnolia I've ever
seen.
It's
been a great year for magnolia.
Yeah.
It really has.
Fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's learn a little bit more about penstemon. How about it?
Yeah, it's a great plant, as I said before. It's just all over the country. It's a native. It gets taken domestic from time to time, the best are. And a man named Dale Lindgren, professor of horticulture and landscape ecology and design at the University of Nebraska in North Platte. He works with extension educators, commercial firms, and growers, as well as with master gardening training. As such, he's developed a strong interest in native plants and wildflowers and finding and developing new cultivars of penstemon. He's going to tell us all about it. So, Dale, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you. Glad to be visiting with you today.
Great.
Good. Thank you very much. We read you're a pretty busy guy reading your biography and the things you've been doing. So let's get started. But kind of give us a day in the week or a month of Dale Lindgren and what got you off so far off course in life that you're actually pursuing plants and across the native prairies of Nebraska.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm a native Nebraskan.
That helps, yeah.
And so I enjoy Nebraska and... I guess maybe one of my first callings in life was not plants. I was real interested in math, and then the one semester of calculus, I decided that I needed to get out of that.
Yeah, brother.
And get into the plants, and I always enjoyed plants on there. But I actually work at the University of Nebraska West Central Center, which is about 240 miles west of the main campus.
In North Platte, right, or close to
North Platte, Nebraska, And if you're not familiar with North Platte, it has the largest railroad facility in the United States.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Is there a South Platte?
A South Platte? Well, there's a South Platte River.
Okay.
And there's a North Platte River.
Okay.
And at North Platte, they joined to form the Platte River.
There you go.
Oh, there we go. Okay. So what is the primary focus of the horticultural research that you do, Dale?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have a split appointment, and I have a 50% extension appointment and a 50% research appointment. And the extension appointment covers just about anything in horticulture in West Central Nebraska. My training is actually in plant breeding and genetics, and I really worked in the area of vegetables, but they were looking for an ornamental plant breeder here at North Platte. So a lot of my work, originally they had a chrysanthemum and a carnation breeding program here, and we've sort of phased that out, although we have a few of that, and we're really concentrating on the area of our native plants, low maintenance, low water requiring plants.
So is that a direct result just in terms of the consumer demands or environmental sorts of issues? Why were you all, or why did you turn your focus on to native plants?
Well, one of the gentlemen that worked here before I did, his name was Glenn Viemeyer, and he did quite a bit of work on penstemon. And I really like penstemon because although it's a native plant, you also find it throughout North America, and of course it's been hybridized and it's used a lot in Europe too, so we just felt that there was a lot of potential for that plant. And it was a native plant, but it's also one that...
Recognizable in a ornamental sort of way.
Right. Well, Dale, let's talk some about how you go from finding a native plant to working into the laboratory in North Platte. What's the process involved here to make it eventually a commercial plant?
Okay. Well, first of all, we actually have two or three ways that we release native plants. One is that, for example, on penstemon, there's been relatively little work done on the genus. And you can go out, for example, we can find fields here that probably have hundreds of thousands of penstemon plants. And you can go into those populations and find something that's new or somewhat different. For example, we released one, a Penstemon grandiflorus plant, and Penstemon grandiflorus, the common name is the shell-leaf Penstemon. I happened to be out one weekend going to a wedding. We saw a white-flowered one, and we don't see a white-flowered one very often.
Wow.
And so we marked that plant and ended up going back during the winter when there was snow on the ground. But anyway, we found the plant, and then from that we saved seed, and we thought, well, now we're going to have a white-flowered one. But the problem was it's a recessive trait that controls
right.
that color.
Right.
So we had to end up doing some other work on it, and we finally developed a population, which is essentially 100% white flowering, but we have to isolate it from mm-hmm. other plants.
How long does that take? What's the process involved?
Well, we figure that on an average it takes at least 8 years from the time you start with the plant till you release a variety. And I must admit there are some plants we worked on that we finally just couldn't find what we were looking for.
So you give up.
So we just count it up as hard knocks or a good lesson.
Right.
On to the next one. But mm-hmm. we try to have all several things in the mix at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just putting all our eggs in one basket. We have a number of things going. Like on Penstemon, we have 10 native species in Nebraska, and some of those have good potential. Some of them don't have a lot of potential. And the reason is that they're very challenging to grow in a home garden. A lot of times the color maybe isn't quite as nice as we'd like. So we have a number of those going. We're not afraid to look at species. We have species from Mexico that we're looking at,
mm-hmm.
and the western United States as well. So we sort of concentrate on Penstemon. We sort of concentrate on plants that are Midwest to West.
So are you doing, in terms of the propagation process, you talked about collecting seeds. Is that how you're always going to collect them from the wild, or will you take cuttings, for example, or are you doing any work, you know, where, for example, you know, you're crossing a species that is, you know, from one part of the country with another from another part of the country so that you can create a plant that's perhaps has a more diverse cultural environment?
Okay. Well, first of all, when we collect plant material, we do seeds, we do cuttings.
So everything.
Yeah, everything. Uh-huh. But some plants don't propagate real well from cutting, so then we take seeds.
But okay.
As far as making crosses, we've made thousands of crosses between species.
Hmm.
And out of those crosses, about 11% of those have actually produced seed, but only about 5% of those have actually produced seed that has germinated.
Oh.
Okay.
So it's a very low percentage.
Okay. So you're focusing more on then that selection from nature. Then.
Right.
Okay.
But we have some nice crosses. For example, we have one of the species we've been working with is Penstemon barbatus. We've crossed a yellow selection we found out of that one with some of our Penstemon colbia, which is a large flowered one, and we really have some interesting progeny on there showing up. They have flowers like one species and the colors like the other one, and they've,
mm-hmm.
they've done very well for us. We've used Husker Red in the cross between some other species, and we have real good seedlings coming out of those, too.
Yeah, well, Dale, I want to get back to the perennial plant of the year, the Husker Red, 1996 champion, but give our listeners a sense, if you can, of what Penstemons look like, or is they so diverse you really can't do that? I mean, tall
well,
and that kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, Penstemon are really in the snapdragon family.
Okay.
Okay. So if you know what a snapdragon looks like, then you sort of have an idea what a Penstemon will look like. They're also related to digitalis or the foxglove.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so most of them are spiky. This isn't always the case. There's some ground cover types like Penstemon pinnifolius, Larissa foleus, and those are more small growing ones. But in general, they have an upright stalk on them, have flowers sort of like a digitalis flower,
okay.
a foxglove flower. And the smallest plants will only be a few inches tall. The tallest one, like Penstemon murrayensis, will get up to 6 or 7 feet tall.
Well, then the Husker Red, the plant of the year in 96, is the one we find on the market similar, if not identical, to the one you found in the wild, or did it take a lot of work to get that thing ready for commercial production?
Well, we originally found that down by a lady's pasture in southeast Nebraska.
Hmm.
And it was in the spring, and we saw it flowering, and normally they have green foliage, and this one had some red in it. So we we asked her to collect seed for us, which she did later on, and she sent us a seed. And then we grew the seed out, and it really segregated for a foliage color for green or red. There was a lot of variation in the foliage as well as the flower color itself, anywhere from white to sort of a light lavender. And so we went through three generations, and we selected out the very best plants that we liked, and then we intercrossed all those.
Wow.
And we did this for three generations. And we finally came up with a plant that we thought had the foliage that we liked, the red foliage and the white flowers. The first company we released it to, they decided to propagate it in tissue culture, and we sent them one plant, and they ended up the next spring having 6,000 plants ready to sell.
Wow.
The rest is history, huh?
Yeah. But one slight problem we have with it is that a lot of the nurserymen propagate it from seed instead of from cuttings. And what happens is that a lot of the seedlings do not breed true.
Right. Okay.
And so we do have times where we see Husker Red being sold, but it has greenish foliage.
Diluted.
Instead of the red foliage.
Yeah.
And that's because it's seed propagated.
So how many different species of penstemon are there? Loads, right?
Okay. First of all, the species runs all the way from Alaska, and there's one down in Guatemala.
Okay.
And so there's about 270 species, and that varies a little bit because the botanists don't always agree with
right.
species, subspecies on there. So we say about 270.
Okay. And predominantly, is it fair to say, Dale, that they are what we consider drought tolerant? They prefer or demand really good drainage, I suspect, you know, for the Kentuckiana area and southern Indiana. So in terms of our zone 6-7 weather, where we're going to have wetter winters and the summers always remain to be seen until it's all said and done.
Right.
What would be some of the better selections for growing in our area?
Well, first of all, in those type of areas, we usually recommend, you know, you have good drainage, as you indicated, and some people use, you know, grow them on raised beds or gravel beds.
Mm-hmm.
But the first place I would start with are the species that are native to a particular portion of a state. For example, Penstemon digitalis, Penstemon hirsutus, Penstemon tubiflorus, these are all more of the eastern type species. Those are some that we recommend to beginners if they're just starting into Penstemon. We sort of hate to start them on some real challenging ones to grow because then they get discouraged. So another one that we like here in our breeding program that we have two or three crosses with is one called Penstemon tenuis.
Tenuous?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we like that one because, at least in our plots, it reflowers. And so many of them do not reflower that second time. So anyway, the eastern species would be the ones I would start with.
So are they typically, going to be blooming in early summer, in summer? You mentioned that the tenuous will rebloom, but are the other ones more of like an early summer sort of bloomer?
They're late spring to early flowering.
Okay.
And we usually say on an average of 3 weeks.
Okay.
And they're available, I would assume, in most catalogs or a lot of garden catalogs?
Garden catalogs, but they're still one of the species which, you know, a lot of people aren't familiar with.
Yeah, they don't seem to be as mainstream as perhaps they should be.
Right. But anyway, we usually recommend that, you know, people start with the ones that are native in their particular area.
But Dale, what's your sense of a good companion plant for the Penstemons?
Well, for example, we like the Coreopsis with the yellow colors. We like some of the salvias because of the blue content.
Right. The same tough.
Well, and exactly, they're the same toughness, and they also demand that good drainage in the wintertime here for us if you want them to winter over. So that makes a lot of sense just in terms of care and culture.
And then with the flowering time, for example, we have a species here, Penstemon, called Penstemon nididus. And it's really native to further north into North Dakota and Wyoming, Montana. And it's almost ready to bloom now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can we get a better name than Beard Tongue?
I'll address that in a second, okay? But anyway, the Penstemon nididus, it has these bright blue flowers on it. And we have it right next to Husker Red, which has the red foliage on it now.
Okay.
And so then it sort of switches later on. The foliage is nice on nididus, and then that one's out flowering, so there's some nice contrast there. But anyway, you mentioned the common name Beard's Tongue, and people think, now, where did they come up with a name like that? Penstemon has what we call a staminode, and a staminode is a sterile stamen
mm-hmm.
or an anther.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it real closely, you see this thing sticking out of the flower close to the lip of the flower,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like a tongue.
There you go.
And it looks like it has a beard on it. It's all covered with hair. It's like a tongue with hair on it. So
a hairy tongue can't be.
Yeah, so they call it beard tongue.
That's a good way to end our discussion on Penstemon. Very interesting. I've jotted down some notes. You've inspired me to add some additional Penstemon to my well-drained beds, at least.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Dale.
Dale, thank you.
Okay.
Dale Lindgren is professor of horticulture and landscape ecology and design at the University of Nebraska in North Platte. He's also editor of the American Penstemon Society's Bulletin. For more information on Dale, the Society, or Penstemons, visit our homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, the Wilderness Society's Ben Beach discusses the early days of Earth Day with its creator, the late Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And you know, Bob, a couple weeks ago was that reference, I guess we can say, to Earth Day. It's not like a specific day exclusively, but it kind of moves.
It's a state of mind, actually.
It really is, yeah. And it got me thinking about, Earth Day's been around for a really long time. I wonder how it started. It manifests itself in so many different ways. In grassroots ways and in schools and that sort of thing today. But how did it all start? And there's apparently a pretty interesting story once I started doing a little digging. So Ben Beach is joining us now to discuss the beginnings of Earth Day. It is a celebration that started big in 1970. It's continued to grow ever since, but as I said, sort of in odd little leaps and bounds in different places. Ben Beach is the Deputy Vice President of Communications for the Wilderness Society and certainly has kept his eye on Earth Day over the years. Ben, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've got warm feelings toward Louisville, and I'm happy to be talking to some people down there.
Great, 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 great. That's always good to hear. Listen, Earth Day, I think that we sort of take it for granted now. There's celebrations all across the country. There have been for 35 years. I didn't realize it was so old, in fact. I think I'm just 1 year older than Earth Day.
But I'm envious.
Right.
In terms of how it started out, I think I read somewhere it was like a couple of million people, which is pretty significant. And the numbers of people that celebrate it today, do you know how much it's grown over the years? Do you have any idea?
You find all kinds of estimates, and it's a very difficult thing to judge
mm-hmm.
because you've got crowd estimates. And, of course, much of what happens is really not capable of being measured at all because it's kids in various classes
mm-hmm.
doing things. So I really haven't seen anything. There's an organization called Earth Day Network, which may take a stab at it, but...
too hard to tell, really.
Yeah. I did see that it had grown from being held only in this country to being celebrated in, I think, 180 countries.
I was wondering about that. So it is international now.
It is.
Cool. Well, the man behind the idea of Earth Day was Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his sensibilities, really, in terms of his motivation for, you know, having some sort of Earth Day celebration?
He was very frustrated during his early years in the Senate. He arrived there in 1962, I believe, because he felt that the American people really were increasingly concerned about the air, the water, their land, wildlife. And yet he saw no real evidence that the people around him on Capitol Hill were really tuned into that. And he used to say that he could count on one hand, maybe two, how many people up there would have called themselves environmentalists. Nobody talked like that. And so his feeling was if only he could get some demonstration that the American people really did care about this, that would have a great impact on the elected leaders who would then take up the cause to one extent or another. So that's what he was searching for, is a way to show that the people cared. And he was out at giving a speech in Santa Barbara in 1969 at the time that there was an oil spill offshore. And then on a flight up north in California, he was reading about Vietnamese war teach-ins as part of the anti-war movement, and he thought, maybe we could do something like that on the environment. And so his thinking sort of evolved, and he gave a speech in Seattle in late 69 saying there ought to be something like this, and suddenly his switchboard just lit up, and people really did respond.
Mm-hmm.
And I think actually there were 20 million that first Earth Day,
mm-hmm.
which was way beyond anything he ever conceived of, and he didn't even think really this was going to be an annual thing.
Yeah, Ben, something I think about almost every day, because this is the mothership, it's the only planet we got. Why is it a tough sell at all? Is it the politics? Why doesn't the whole world embrace the fact we got one planet here, we're polluting it, let's get it straightened out?
Well, that is a good question, Bob.
I think about it all the time.
I think it's because, in part, a misconception that if you do something that is good for the environment, then there is a cost to it economically.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of zero-sum game is out there, whereas there's more and more evidence that if we have bad air, then you're going to have sicker people, and if you've got dirty water, you're going to have to pay to clean it up at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But we just don't have a very good accounting system for incorporating those costs. So I think that's part of it. And, of course, a lot of people have so much on their minds, and
sometimes
the environment suffers for that reason.
Right.
Well, Ben, do you think, like, because I think back to the 1960s and particularly in certain parts of the country, a pivotal time in terms of activism, civil rights, and naturally you would think that the whole sort of environmental activism would be born out of the other activism, you know, that was moving forward in the 1960s and into the 70s. So is there some truth in the statement that the time was ripe for some sort of environmental movement because of other things that were going on? And then, you know, I think back to Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring. You know, how does that sort of information encourage, or as you say, I guess, you know, make big business more fearful of environmental movements in terms of what's going on socially, politically, economically, you know, in any given decade?
Well, boy, there's a lot in all you're saying there.
Yeah.
Let me offer just a few observations from my perspective. I think, yes, that there was sort of an orientation at that period to try to do something about problems. And so the fact that people were energized about the war, once another cause caught their attention, I think it was sort of a natural thing to get active on that as well. And I think that Rachel Carson, obviously she had a lot to do with the success of the movement. And I think that she laid some scientific groundwork for it that was important,
mm-hmm.
and got a lot of people thinking about things that perhaps they hadn't really thought about before.
Did big business embrace this new sort of movement that obviously the people were embracing, or was there a bit of fear, you know, in terms of the economic bottom line being hurt? Because I kind of think that that's going on today with many things, is that certain big businesses don't want to clean up or have or embrace certain types of legislation because they fear it's going to hurt their bottom line. So how did they respond back in 1970?
Well, you know, there are, I don't know how many businesses in this country and how many business people, and so the reactions ran the gamut, but you certainly had people in the business world who saw this as a threat, and that, okay, if I've got to clean up the water coming out of my factory, or if I've got to clean up the air that I'm putting out there, or if I'm not allowed to develop a certain forest or this or that, then that is going to cost me money. There was some resistance for that reason. Other companies could see that there was money to be made. And, you know, someone's got to make the equipment that's going to clean the
mm-hmm.
pollution going out of those factories. somebody who's whoever can come up with a cleaner, more efficient car mm-hmm. is going to make some money. So there are winners and losers.
Gotcha.
And then I think that there's also the short-term, long-term struggle that faces all business people and it faces politicians. And you can say that, I know that if we clean up the air and take good care of our land and wildlife, that's long-term going to be good for us. But I got to think about the next month, the next year, the next 2 years, and whether you're a politician or you're in business, you may just have trouble getting over that hump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get in the whole spotted owl thing where you get the spotted owl as a symbol of losing 30,000 lumber jobs and so forth. But
right.
I'm kind of encouraged by the fact recently that, A, the states are taking charge instead of the federal government in a lot of areas, and, B, you see both sides of the aisle in Congress. I think the people are ahead again of government here.
Well, yeah. The Republican Party originally owned the issue that called conservation.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right. If you were to look 100 years ago, he was extraordinarily far-sighted things.
Right.
And now today, things are not going so well with our federal government.
Right.
And you've got all kinds of views within both parties, really, but there's probably more variety within the Republican Party on environmental or conservation issues, and it's kind of ironic. Conservation should be the sort of issue that conservatives would embrace, but oftentimes conservatives do what is not very conservative on land and wildlife and the quality of air and water. And so the states, as you noted, because they're frustrated by inaction or reversal of progress at the federal level right now, see opportunities to act on their own. And this happens on a number of issues, but it's particularly noticeable on the environment right now, and healthcare as well. For example, with Massachusetts and Oregon sort of deciding, well, we got a serious healthcare problem. The federal government is not able to come to grips with it. We're going to try to do it ourselves.
Right.
And so the states are great incubators of progressive ideas.
Mm-hmm. So, since we're talking about sort of a legislative sort of component to all this, it seems like one of the strongest legacies of the Earth Day movement, if you will, is the legislation that was passed in the early 1970s when there really wasn't. I mean, Ben, had there prior to some of the Clean Water and the Air Acts that were passed? I mean, the EPA was established in the 1970s. Were all of those things a direct reaction to that Earth Day and environmental movement?
Well, that's often the way it is presented, and that may be a bit of an exaggeration, but it really gave tremendous impetus to that whole legislative movement. I have a list in front of me of headline major federal environmental initiatives since Earth Day 1970, and there are about 25 really major mm-hmm. laws down there, and I think a lot of these things people understood ought to have been done, but once you had the people saying, we really think this is a very important issue and we want you to do something about it,
mm-hmm.
then we started getting all these major laws passed.
Yeah, Ben, when did it go international, the movement?
Well, I don't think I could give you an exact year. I would say it probably was a matter of 5 or 10 years, but I just don't, I'd be guessing.
5 or 10 years ago or
five or ten years after it
started?
I would say it happened probably
straight
the
away.
Course of the 70s.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always been, at least in Europe, a reasonably strong interest in a lot of these things, and they're ahead of us in a lot of ways. So I suspect that the first countries to pick up on this were in Western Europe, and they probably moved within a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and then other countries came along thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Gaylord Nelson, had he stayed engaged in environmental issues and in the celebration of Earth Day?
Yeah,
in
he got revved up every year as it came around, and he would do a number of interviews, and often before he got into his late 70s and 80s, he would have a pretty ambitious schedule of speeches he would give around that time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I think about the fact that here's this one guy who came up with this one idea and just what an impact it had, it sort of gives you a faith that that if we are creative, just that one thing mm-hmm. can set in motion a whole lot of positive efforts mm-hmm. that pay dividends years and years down the road. So now I forgot what your original question
was.
Oh,
just how, that's okay. But I mean, that's sort of it, just to how the impact of his idea and then the fact that he stayed engaged in environmentalism and the true spirit of Earth Day, whether or not he was in politics or not.
Yeah, so. I remember the point I wanted to make is he lost his Senate seat in 1980. Mm-hmm. So he then had a number of choices, and one choice is very hard for a former member of Congress, and he's also a former governor, and he was a lawyer. One thing that's really hard to resist is an enormous paycheck from some lobbying firm in Washington or somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I've always admired him for being able to push that aside. And he was a guy who didn't have any wealth of his own. Mm-hmm. He was the son of a doctor. He was never suffering, but he never had a lot of wealth, but he was so committed to this cause that when he left Congress, he came to the Wilderness Society and spent the rest of his life, which is about 25 years, coming in here day after day after day, and he came in here until probably the last 3 months of his life when he just couldn't do it physically.
Mm-hmm. So your Wilderness Society coordinates most Earth Day activities, or is there a single...
Well, not really, Bob. There was a time, perhaps, when we did more. But one thing that's really significant, I think, about Earth Day is how little organization there really is. And this is something that Gaylord Nelson liked to talk about. He announced this idea and came up with the date of April 22nd. And he did not then go out and try to organize campuses or anything. The phone calls just came in. He hired a guy named Dennis Hayes, who was a student at the time, to oversee the office that he had to set up here as the volume of response was so large. But as he always put it, Earth Day organized itself. Yeah. And it is still that way. If you're a teacher or community leader, whatever, you just sort of go off and do it. And you might call a local environmental group or a national group for some ideas or some literature or a speaker, but basically there's enough information out there online or whatever that you just do it on your own. Mm-hmm. And so there's no, even though there is an Earth Day network that provides some overall guidance and
sort of a mission statement from which you can spring. I think that's the value of the whole thing, is that it allows people to organize in a more grassroots sort of way.
Right.
So you can kind of take the information and use it to your best advantage, depending on what's going on in your community as well.
Yeah.
So,
and one of the wonderful things is that people do not need a push to organize these things.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
Now, obviously, individual citizens may need to be encouraged to come out and
participate. Mm-hmm.
But if nobody nationally did a thing, there would still be all these activities. Mm-hmm. Because I think, in part, people understand that it's important, they care about it, and teachers see it as a good learning opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Listen, the Wilderness Society, you're the Deputy Vice President of Communications for the Wilderness Society. What's the primary function of your organization?
We are committed to trying to protect America's wilderness and the benefits of it, wildlife, recreation, the economic benefits that it provides. It cleans our air and our water. And our bread and butter is what we call the public lands, and that's mm-hmm. 623 million acres that you two and everybody, well, every American citizen owns just by being an American. The national parks, national forests, national wildlife refuges like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and then a big chunk of western land administered by the Bureau of Land Management.
Mm-hmm.
So we believe that our generation needs to take good care of that land and pass it on to future generations.
Thank you, Ben.
Sure, enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
Good talking to you both.
Ben Beach is the Deputy Vice President of Communications for the Wilderness Society. He spoke to us from their headquarters in Washington, D.C. If you'd like more information, please visit our website at wfpl.org. Coming up, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we're here to answer some questions.
That's right.
Correctly or not, but
correctly
we
or
all
not.
Paid the same, apparently. Right. Let me start with one that maybe the easiest, but yet most maybe interesting and entertaining. On the way into the building today, we were stopped by a young lady carrying this beautiful, bright yellow flower mm-hmm. on a wonderful shrub with green leaves. And she
right.
said, "What is this?" And Janine knew right away.
Well, because they're delightful and they're so showy this year.
Mm-hmm.
This time of the year, definitely right. this year, but this time of the year. But she was wondering what she had, basically. So she was smart enough to bring in a great sample.
To us.
And it's a Keria japonica,
right.
K-E-R-R-I-A,
right.
japonica. There are single flowering types, double flowering types, named cultivars,
variegated
straight species.
Variegated leaf ones,
too. Variegated leaf ones, exactly. They bloom in... on the north side of your house or on the south side of your house.
They bloom in the shade,
yeah.
almost.
It's great, yeah.
yeah.
They don't need a lot of sun. They are rather tolerant of dry conditions,
mm-hmm.
and they're so vigorous. Basically, she was wondering, you know, this thing's kind of getting out of control. You know, how do we maintain it? And like anything else, I always say, cut out the oldest wood all the way to the ground.
You're a mean woman, Janine Wishy.
Cut out the oldest part.
Mean woman.
Oh, Bob, you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. They are, and they're underused, I think.
I think so, too.
They should be used more. They divide easily.
Mm-hmm.
They're
tough
infallibly
as nails, really.
Yeah, bright yellow, and I do have them in the shade.
Yeah.
And they do remarkable. I got one next to a purple rhododendron, which sounds awful, and a white hawthorn tree. But it's out my kitchen window, and I just mm-hmm. love that view.
Yeah. And it's a real kind of naturalized-looking plant,
mm-hmm.
too. It's not formal or stuffy in any way.
Yeah.
Very nice. Blooms best this time of the year, but then will continue to bloom sporadically
yep.
throughout the summer.
It'll be back.
Keria japonica, definitely a good addition to any garden.
Yeah.
All right, Bob. This gentleman is looking for some additional ideas for additions to his garden. It is from Gary Martin, and he writes, he'd like to plant deciduous shade trees around his house. Do you know of any particular species, native or not, that would be least, I like the way it words this,
yeah.
that would be least likely to be blown over by high winds? Is there any type of arrangement or grouping of trees that would make them less susceptible to being blown over by wind forces? And Gary Martin is in Shelby County, Kentucky, my county.
Yeah, I think what he wants is the tree least likely to grow fast.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
The question really embodies a whole bunch of different concepts,
right.
doesn't it?
Exactly.
So number one, avoid fast-growing trees.
Yeah, like the water maples and... other trees are considered...
like catalpas, those
junk trees.
Yeah.
They're quick shade, unless you're going to sell the house. No,
uh-huh.
don't do that.
Right.
Don't do that to the next homeowner.
Yeah, no.
I just avoid those fast-growing trees, totally.
They're usually weak. I mean, that's the whole thing with the
yeah.
Bradford pear, too. They're pretty quick growers. They're a little too compact for their own good, and then they, you know, get torn open by winds because they're on the weak side, and they're just a little too compact.
There are some compromised trees, like the elm.
Mm-hmm.
What's the elm?
The lace bark elm.
Lace bark elm
uh-huh.
grows pretty quick and gets big, pretty
yeah.
strong.
But it's a strong tree, right?
Right.
So he's looking for some examples. Some of the good trees for our area, I think, that are good solid trees. The swamp white oak, if you want that sort of majestic big shade tree. The ash,
mm-hmm.
a great strong tree. Black gums, sweet gums, good traditional
just oaks,
strong
a lot of oaks.
Trees. Yeah.
yeah, oaks will do.
Scarlet oaks are beautiful. Sassafras for something a little smaller.
And I have a lot of sugar maples. Now they're slow. These are slow growing, but that's
what you're going to get.
What
if
you want. Yeah.
And also too, it begs the a little discussion on the whole tree health.
Right.
Compacted soil. Don't make sure you don't have compacted soil, or do the best that you can to maintain good soil health. Make sure that you water your trees to get them established. That's key to anything mm-hmm. beyond fertilization, making sure there's adequate moisture. So selecting the right tree for the right site is extremely important in terms of whether or not it's going to fall on your house or not later.
Yeah, and in terms of grouping, you really
prune
can't
it properly.
Group these big slow growing trees because you're going to plant them 30 feet apart. You
mm-hmm.
have to.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to make yourself do that. But if you don't, they're going to be bumping into each other.
Yeah. So give them plenty of room as well so that you don't have to do some wacky thing later in terms of pruning. So, that's a yellow wood is another tree that comes to mind that I love. Cladastrus kentuckia. Obviously, it's native to these parts. A really lovely tree as well.
As is the Kentucky coffee tree.
That's right. So
lots
there you
things.
Go.
Yeah.
All right. This is from James Roy Bob. He says, around my house, I've put down weed control fabric. On that, I have about 1.5 inches of rock instead of using mulch. My problem is still I have weeds and especially wild onions coming through the fabric. I also have some shrubs planted in the bed. His question is, what kind of weed killer can he use to control the weed growth and not hurt his plants? I've looked at several sprays on the market, but I found that none are safe, or he feels like none are safe to use around his plants. He tries to keep the weeds pulled by hand, but they get ahead of him.
Yeah, well,
so any suggestions?
Yeah. Next to morning glory vine, my pet peeve is fabric. It doesn't work.
The landscape fabric doesn't.
Doesn't work. And invariably, you get roots coming up through that thing, and it's hard to pull out once it gets established. I just spent about an hour last weekend
pulling some out.
Ripping out some fabric.
Because anytime organic matter accumulates on top of it, seeds are going to germinate. So it is kind of a waste of money and time.
Anyway, I weed by hand as much as I can. Use Roundup where I can't, basically. I'm careful with it, but that's what I use, a total kill.
Right. And the shrubbery thing, most products are contact-based products.
Right.
So you have to get the product on the foliage of whatever you want to kill. So just be very careful about using any sort of contact weed killer, and make sure you don't get it on the foliage of your shrubs, and you should be okay.
Yeah, avoid windy days.
Yeah,
because I've done that.
Exactly.
I just accidentally went, whoop, I ate acres of stuff.
Yeah.
And I've killed some stuff I did not want to kill.
Right. So there you go. Don't bother with the landscape fabric and just keep hand pulling and honestly, you're using mulch is going to probably do you better than using gravel or rock in the long run. So just plain old mulch, 1.5 to 2 inches, might do the trick better than anything else
all. Good for grandma's good for you.
That's right. All right. How can people ask us questions if they are consternated in the garden?
Consternated?
We may or may not be able to help them.
If you have a consternated question, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, I've been told by coaches for 40 years to strap it on and get out there.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm going to get that in Latin.
Not an image that I really want to have, Bob.
Well, we're talking about shoulder pads.
Okay, good.
Okay.
The Latin word of the week this week is laurifolius.
Okay.
So lore is, in Latin, is strap.
Yeah.
Laura, or strap-like. So my girlfriend Lori, I guess it's because she's so strapping is why she was named Lori.
Okay.
But L-O-R-I, folius.
Right.
Laura folius with strap-like foliage.
Yeah. Wow.
So I found a couple of examples.
Okay.
There's a Narcissus laura folius, which makes loads of sense.
That'd be like a daffodil in common parlance with big strapping leaves.
With strapping leaves.
Oh, yeah. Cinnamon coach.
Sarcanthus laura folius is a type of orchid with
big strapping leaves. There's the theme here.
And then the genus Loranthus.
I'm a genius.
You are. The genus Loranthus.
Okay.
Strap flower. The strap flower.
Strap flower.
Yeah.
The common strap flower.
The common strap flower. Yeah. Loropetalum.
Oh, one of my favorite plants.
The Asian witch hazel.
It is. It grows.
Really?
That's a beautiful plant that has purple flowers.
Mm-hmm.
It grows all over Georgia and Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hardy here. I have it in the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
People stop me every weekend and
does
say,
does it have petalums that are just strapping?
Yes.
Cool.
It does.
See, it makes sense.
It does.
Learning about all this stuff makes sense.
If I get a hardy one, it's going to take over the Bradford pears, the next big thing.
Awesome.
It's a gorgeous plant.
Cool. All right.
But I digress.
And that's quite all right. I'm used to it. And I could have sworn, but I'm not certain.
Not in the air.
That Dale Lindgren said that there was a Penstemon laurisifolius.
I saw your eyes shoot up.
Did you see me scribble something down?
My God, we learned something here.
So true to our expectations of the Penstemon and its many species, there is a Penstemon Larissa Folius, that let's just hope there's something about the foliage of this penstemon that's strappy.
We wouldn't have it any other way.
I misread the botanical
Latin.
Maybe
time to strap on the accent and get out of here.
Maybe it is. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Art Walk and saving pennies in the garden. We could all use a little help that way. And Aurelia Scott, otherwise normal people inside the thorny world of competitive rose gardening.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost in the wholly organic studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.